Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. And on tonight's episode of Voice of Olympus, I'm proud to bring you Living Elenius Moss with Tony Merzwicki. Greetings and welcome, Tony. How are you?
I'm doing really well, Hercules. How are you today?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm looking forward to tonight's show. Your guest is here, so I will let him in.
Excellent. So, our guest today is Denny Sargent. I recently reviewed his latest book titled Werewolf Magic, Authentic Practical Lycanthropy. But first, a little bit of background on him. Denny Sargent, also known as Eon 131 and Hermeticus Nath, is a Seattle writer, artist, and university instructor whose extensive global travels and esoteric studies have informed the backbone to numerous published books. Having been involved for decades with numerous esoteric traditions, the author has published works on alternative religions, hermetic magic, Taoism, animism, Shinto, and Tantra. Published books include Global Ritualism, The Tao of Birthdays, Your Guardian Angel and You, Clean Sweep, The Book of the Horned One, Naga Magic, Dancing with Spirits, Werewolf Magic, which we just talked about, and Dog Magic. Denny regularly presents lively online workshops and lectures and previously hosted at conventions and gatherings. He's currently residing in the Pacific Northwest, and he invites and welcomes conversation on all manner of subject matter. Denny, thanks for making yourself available and coming on the show. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I'm really excited to have you on the show tonight. I really enjoyed your book, which I just reviewed. So it's very apparent to me that you have a very extensive background in the practice of magic and other esoteric modalities. Could you discuss how you came to immerse yourself in werewolf magic and channel the system which you've presented in your book?
Sure. My life is pretty much occult practices and occult studies, and I came out of getting my master's degree in ancient history, and it evolved into linguistics and other things, but from a young child, I've been obsessed with the gods, especially the Greek gods, the Norse gods, and I knew I was a pagan when I was 9 years old. And when I was leading my friends in games of playing temple and gods and all these crazy things, I had no idea what I was doing. I was a witch in New York City in the 70s. I was initiated into the Welsh traditional witchcraft and then moved into studying basically everything occult, read everything by Crowley. There was a small group of us. We were crazy teenagers, and we evolved together and did Golden Dawn rituals, read everything, like I said, read everything by Crowley, did a whole bunch of his rituals, et cetera, et cetera. So I've always been in this. So I've always been practicing, was initiated in a tantric lineage, the Adinath Sampradaya, in 1980. So I'm one of those people that just sort of, you know, I tried everything and it seemed to gravitate towards me. So I've been in this world. Werewolf magic was something very, very different. It was not something I found. It found me. So about 5 years ago, I had a disastrous year of just everything falling apart. I lost my wife at that point, and my house and everything, basically everything. My entire life exploded. People say, oh, yeah, it was that second Saturn return, I guess. So I don't know. All I know is that I ended up extremely depressed and felt bereft of the gods and of my holy guardian angel who I had already bonded with. I mean, I felt completely abandoned and figured I was pretty much done with my work and continued meditating, but was in a very, very bad state. At a certain point in my meditation, a spirit entity or God form, whatever you want to call it, started showing up uncalled for in my meditation. Now, I banish quite thoroughly before I meditate, and I focus on really more tantric stuff. But this three-eyed wolf kept showing up, and basically coming up to me and looking at me and communicating, I can help you with getting past this. And so I said, well, you know what, I'm kind of at the end of my rope, so why not? So what I got was to get out, just to get out of myself, of my world, of my life. And I just hopped in the car and drove up into the mountains. Now, I live an hour and a half away from real wilderness up in the Cascade Mountains. And essentially just threw myself into nature. I ripped off all my clothes and just camped without thinking of anything. I had really nothing with me. And I just sort of threw myself into Gaia, into nature. And I said, you know, remake me. I was really past words at that point. And this wolf spirit came, and it filled me, and it sort of shredded through all this horrible stuff, this self-hate and all this neuroses and all of this stuff. And I came out of it a kind of, I hate to say it was like a born-again kind of experience, but I was born within nature and came out completely reborn with a deep understanding that what had happened was going to take me months to figure out. But then I started just writing and scribing all this stuff about what was happening. The bottom line is that we have lost touch with our ecosystem, with nature. And this is the root cause of everything horrible happening in the world today. Native peoples I've hung out with around the world, I've traveled to about 30 countries, like rural Guatemala or rural Oaxaca or rural Cambodia. The people who are the tribal people accept that they are part of nature. They refer to animals as other people. This is a normal thing in a lot of these cultures. We're the only ones in this sort of Judeo-Christian and also in Islamic and in all these monotheistic religions, it is painted that man is superior to nature and man is superior to animals, and that God gave us, you know, custody of the world to do with as we will. And so this separation between us and nature has gotten deeper and thicker to the point where we literally are poisoning our own water and land, and we literally are killing ourselves and trying to, you know, it's just insane. And so it seems very simple, but the revelation, the sort of hypothesis I had was I have to smash through this fake, deep set programming. And that's what werewolf magic is all about. So then I started researching, like, I'm like, okay, why werewolf? Why wolves? Why werewolves? What's going on here? This is crazy. I had no intention of writing a book, by the way. I was just trying to find my way out of my pit, you know? And this wolf kind of was leading me through this. So I started creating rituals and coming up with ideas and meditating on it and focusing on it. And focusing on less words and more animal sounds in terms of ritual work. And it evolved, and I took it and five other proposals to Pantheacon, assuming that everybody would laugh at it. And that was the one everybody wanted, so I ended up like, look.
Very
not
cool.
A book I planned right. Anyway. Was that more or less what you wanted to me to answer?
Yeah, pretty well. Actually, while you were talking, there was one thing that jumped out at me. You said that when you're in the pits of depression, and embracing werewolf magic enabled you to climb out of that pit. Now, depression is a huge issue in society, and it also seems somewhat of a synchronicity that depression is often referred to as a black dog, you know, black dogs, wolves, you know, same sort of descent. Do you think that possibly other people who are going through depression could drag themselves out of their state by embracing werewolf magic? Just something that jumped out at me. I thought I'd discuss that with you.
You know, I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, so I hate to, you know, tell people what to do in terms of depression. Depression's debilitating and horrible, and you know, I don't generally suffer from it, but those I know who do, it's a real illness and it's a real problem. I will say this though, it's possible. I'm going to say it's possible, but I think what's more important is reconnecting with nature. I think, and this is just a personal opinion, I think a lot of our social ills, a lot of them, especially ills of being depressed or being being frustrated or being overly angry or all of these things that we see happening. Everyone, I mean, obviously we're in a bad time now, but in general, the more civilized we get, the more unhappy we seem to be getting. And my question is, why? I mean, we have more stuff than we've ever had before. We've had, you know, we have pretty much everything we need, except, of course, for the large number of people who don't. But we still, in general, civilization has sort of grown and provided more. But we're less happy. I mean, I ran into people, I hung out with people in, you know, in like the Mien in the mountains of Thailand and the Mayans in Guatemala who had nothing, and they were way happier than we are in general. And the question is, you know, what is it? And honestly, I know this is simplistic, but it's we've disconnected from nature. We've unplugged from our ecosystem. Most of us have no idea what trees are around us, or when we walk into nature, we don't open and feel the energy of nature coming into us and the fact that we are interconnected on every level. Everything we have is from nature, but people who eat meat are horrified at killing animals. I mean, we're just completely disconnected from the reality that nature gives us everything, that we are part of nature. So, I mean, at this point, every time I do any kind of ritual, I always end by honoring the earth, by saying to you, from you, all things, with gratitude, I see people just throwing garbage, and there's no gratitude or connection. To them, nature is like a playpen for them to abuse and use as they want, and animals are seen as non-caring, non-thinking things. So, I mean, I think all of this leads to, I would think, in my opinion, depression and negative feelings on so many levels. I don't know if that's overthinking it, but that's my answer.
No, actually, I don't think it is at all. I've heard a number of people say in the past that they feel that a lot of our ills are a result of being disconnected from nature. And I remember reading the Celestine Prophecy many, many years ago, and in that they recommended going into nature, breathing in energy from nature to recharge our batteries, which is a very simplistic way of looking at the sort of thing that you're advocating.
Yeah, I'm. What I'm trying to do is help people connect by what was shown me, what was taught to me, what I got out of this series of experiences as it sort of snowballed and turned into its own magical system through no fault of my own, was that the way to get through this, the way to break through this, is connect to what I call the animal self. Different people call it different things. Carl Sagan calls it the reptile mind, the lower cortex section. But Jung references it, I think, somewhat in the shadow concept. But we are animals. We are animals, and yet every bit of language we use in the world, at least in the United States, when we refer to people as animal in any kind of way, it's a negative, you know, it's a negative. So we have this idea that we are somehow vastly superior and separate. Most importantly, we're separate, right? Because we have souls and they don't. So breaking through that, I think, is reaching down, connecting with your animal self. And for me, again, I didn't intellectualize this. For me, it's a wolf, and that's what the book is about. And I think there's a lot of history to it, and we'll talk about it in a minute. But in Western culture, the wolf was the apex predator, and these shape-shifting things seem to follow that concept of apex predator. So by pulling my animal self out of my deep, deep, deep unconscious mind, it breaks through the sort of hyper-intellectual, ego-centered cortex, I know everything, or I can know everything, and just sort of breaks through into a direct perception of body to nature, if that makes sense. What the Taoists have called a perceiving, like becoming part of nature without so much thinking and thought and cognition. And those who have been hiking in the woods for weeks at a time, you know, by about a week or a half, 2 weeks when I've been hiking, you enter a trance state where you're just there and you're not thinking, oh, I have to go to a meeting or I have to make a phone call, I have to look at my cell phone. So I guess that's a fairly long way of saying that's the key, is to reconnect with your animal self and truly let it break through that wall.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. And I can't help but noticing that many spiritual disciplines have at their core this need to appreciate the interconnectedness of all life forms. And what you're doing by hiking and embracing your animal self, your wolf self, is basically achieving the same sort of thing, a little bit differently to how other spiritual modalities may go about it, but you're still accomplishing the same thing.
Yes, I mean, what I found traveling is that Buddhists tend to be closest to this because they acknowledge animals as sentient beings who are on par with humans. Shinto
yes.
also very much does. In fact, the werewolf spirit is honored in Shinto as Okami, which is very interesting. Kami being God spirit. It's hard to translate. But O means like the most honored, which I find very fascinating that it's the only God form in Japan called Okami. And so pagan traditions, pagan cultures knew this and accepted this as part of their practices. And I found out in my, you know, I laid out in my book that many different ancient cultures embrace the idea of shape-shifting, and especially in Western culture, the idea of shape-shifting into werewolf, i.e. were being human. So I think some pagan cultures and religions, animist cultures and religions, Buddhism, Hinduism to a certain extent, Tantra more so, are much more inclined to understand that we are, in fact, parts of nature. That's been my experience anyway.
Yeah. You're actually preempting my next question to you. So I was just going to say that your book includes fascinating information on traditions of working with wolves and other apex predators in numerous cultures. My interest is primarily in the ancient Greek traditions, so I was wondering if your involvement in werewolf magic has given you an insight into the ancient Greek myths about werewolves that would not be readily apparent to an outsider.
I think so. I mean, I'm going to be perfectly honest that the roots to this probably started when I was 14, and my mother, bless her heart, this was the 70s, let me go hiking on the Appalachian Trail by myself with a backpack, and she dropped me off and picked me up a week later. I don't think moms do that anymore. But I just knew I had to get into nature and just be there by myself. And that's when I had a very powerful vision of the great god Pan, which was not a deity I had was really familiar with, but he essentially showed up and blessed me. And so the rest of my life, he's been one of my most important solitary deities. It has occurred to me that this is part of that gnosis, this werewolf magic stuff. And then of course I discovered that there are a number of pan-like gods who are connected with wolves, including the most important, the Roman god Faunus, with the Roman Pan, is also the wolf, werewolf god, and his priests were called Luperci, which means werewolf. So that it just seems that these things are all connected. I think if I had been born, for example, in Morocco, it's were hyenas. You know, in parts of Africa, it's were lions. In China, it's were tigers. I think if I had been born Chinese, this might have come through a different way. But this is, I think, how it came to me. So I'm fascinated, and I am a great, great lover of the Greek gods. They were the first gods as a little kid that I read about and enthused about. And so when I started doing, when I started pulling this stuff together, the werewolf magic stuff, it was mostly rituals. I was going out and ripping off my clothes and dancing naked in the woods and doing my own thing. So I started to say, well, I wonder if this was really a thing. And it shocked me to find out about the Mount Lycaon and the, you know, the quote-unquote origin of werewolves was a very, very, a prehistoric temple on top of a mountain in Greece. And I believe it's Arcady, called Mount Lycaon. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. I'm probably not. You guys pronounce all this stuff way better than me. So
Hercules is the expert on Greek pronunciation.
Lycaon, Lycos is wolf, so it's Mount Lycaon.
Lycaon, all right, thank you very much. Yeah, you can step in and correct any of my Greek, that's fine. Without going deeply into the myth, there's a bunch of different versions, but Zeus came and was offered human flesh by the king, who had the same name as the temple. And, of course, it means wolf. Means Wolf Mountain, and he's wolf. So this is a play out of some sort of interesting shift in the magical systems that were taught there. But he offered, you know, Zeus came and in human guise, was offered this flesh, got very angry and turned the king into a werewolf. The myth changes either for 9 years or for life or whatever. But there's a lot of interesting stuff about this particular temple. It then became the temple of Zeus Lycaon. I'm sure I'm saying it wrong again. But so wolfish Zeus is how they refer to it. And then just down the road a few miles is the temple of Pan Lycaon, which is Pan Zeus. Pan the wolf god. So this seems to have been the center of this cult in ancient Greece. And they're, you know, I'm reading about the new digs they're still doing there, and they're finding fossils and bones and whatnot from 4,000 years ago, and they're finding signs of cannibalism as well. And there was a whole series of initiations and whatnot. I found more and more stuff. So it's very intriguing that these temples had these werewolf priests. That's what they were called. So then I started digging further, and then of course I found some more myths in ancient Greece. I didn't realize that Apollo was also pictured as a wolf and was known as a wolfish power, and the wolves were part of his mythos along with his sister Artemis. So it just started snowballing. All of a sudden, I can say apocryphally that the great wolf spirit that had sort of come to me in my hour of need was sort of guiding me and saying, you know, you need to look here, you need to look there, and all of a sudden it was everywhere. And then I found out about Theranos and about his cult, and that they also had werewolf priests. We're into the Roman stuff. And then, of course, there's Lupercalia. Rome was founded by Lupa, the goddess, quote-unquote goddess wolf. Apparently Lupa was worshipped before the founding of Rome, so this is a wolf goddess that has been there for a while. And this is it was a four-day orgy essentially focused on the Roman god Faunus, who also was a wolf god. And there was, you know, fornication and lots of drinking. And the werewolf priest, the Lupercai, would go around wearing goat skins, whipping people with thongs to give them fertility, and Lord knows all of what else was going on. But it goes on and on. I mean, I found, then I started looking into Slavic stuff, and there's a ton of werewolf stuff there. And then I dug deep into the witchcraft trial documents, and was shocked to find out that I would make just a ballpark guess. Two-thirds of witches, that's a ballpark. Two-thirds of witches were also accused of werewolfery, of being werewolves. And the church was stomping out two things at the same time. This idea of shape-shifting magic, which was mostly wolf-oriented, and witchcraft, i.e., which they lumped together as Satanism and all that. So they were basically trying to expurge all the pagan elements that had filtered into Europe. But it shocked me to find out that, you know, witches were routinely accused of also being werewolves. And in fact, I just wrote an article for Llewellyn magazine on witches and werewolves. So I clearly am a little obsessed here.
Well, you basically preempted the next two questions, so I'm starting to run out of questions now. But,
oh, that's okay.
Yeah.
We'll keep talking. I can keep talking.
Yeah, so I was going to ask about non-Greek traditions, but you've covered that. I was also going to ask you about the werewolf trials, which ran parallel to the witch trials. You've covered that. So now I'm going to move on to Hollywood.
Can I add one thing?
Yeah, sure.
One thing I have not talked about is the Norse. And this actually turned out to be an incredibly important piece of the puzzle. Because while most stuff has been destroyed by the church, most of the interesting historical stuff, the Norse managed to, and the Vikings managed to keep some of their, a lot of their magical lore mostly intact in the Eddas, which were smuggled into Iceland before Christianity took over and sort of expelled all of that kind of magic. So this is where we find some of the most clearly historical documentation of werewolves as a real thing. Even when I went to Iceland, I heard people talking about it. They still believe in shape-shifting and werewolves, but they don't see werewolves as a bad thing. Most ancient cultures didn't see it as a bad thing. They saw it as mostly it was a warrior class thing. And I didn't mention ancient Rome, which would a wolf standard was taken into battle, and some of the wolfish brigades that were involved in shape-shifting stuff were done out of a temple of, you know, Mars in Rome and Ares in Greece. So everywhere I looked, I found this stuff. But the Norse stuff was very well documented. We all know about berserkers. Berserkers are these wild, possessed Viking warriors that go into battle. They're possessed by the animal spirit. And berserker comes from bersark, which means the bear skin. So someone who was berserk was literally wearing the skin of the bear. And in a lot of the stuff I read coming out of the Norse tradition, that's how they referred to people who were shapeshifters as, oh, he wears the skin of the wolf, or he wears the skin of the bear, meaning he can take it on and off. This actually ended up showing up in the witchcraft trials much later. But there were a lot of berserkers, but there were also a lot of Ulfsark. Ulfsark were the werewolves. Ulf is wolf, and Sark means skin. So, and they have lots of different titles. But Odin was himself an Ulfsark. Odin was the lord of shapeshifting and was often called upon. These Ulfsark or berserkers, right, the Bersark, they were in direct communion with Odin. They were both sorcerers, shapeshifters, and they were also warriors, which is a very unusual thing in Viking society. So there's a lot there. I mean, there's way much more than I can talk about. But all of this dovetails with the Greek stuff, with the Roman stuff. There's so much more I can talk about. And a lot of these things are verified, I just want to say, by some of the more important ancient historians, like Herodotus and Livy and Petronius. And, I mean, these people all believed in werewolves. They were like, no, I saw it. I went here, you know, Herodotus said, oh, I went here into part what is now Russia, and I watched the entire tribe, the Nuri. I watched them all turn into werewolves at this festival. And, you know, these are people who are trying to document what they saw. So anyway, I just wanted to add a little bit more ancient history because I love ancient history so much.
Okay, so just taking a step away from it, you talked about people being genuine werewolves. What does that actually mean? You talked about putting on a wolf skin. In your book, you talked about people putting on a belt made of wolf skin in order to transform. So are we talking about a physical transformation into a wolf, or taking on the attributes of a wolf, or perhaps just a transformation into a wolf spirit in the astral. What exactly are we talking about? I mean, were there physical transformations like we see in Hollywood movies, or is it just taking on wolfish attributes?
So, I mean, a lot of the mocking I get from this book is I don't think people physically turn into a wolf. I don't think, you know, I do love the movies. They're great fun. But, you know, your jaw popping out and your bones cracking and blood spurting and, you know, all of that, that's not what we're talking about here. And I've had people who have critiqued my book because they start with, well, you know, this is ridiculous. People, this doesn't happen. Well, I'm in agreement there. It does not. But there have been thousands of years of reported werewolves and shape-shifting, and it goes all the way back to shamanism. And I hung out with shamans. I hung out with Siberian shamans in Seattle, and I took courses from them, workshops with them. I interviewed them. I ran into shamans in central Guatemala who were self-identified, who were all of these people were shape-shifters. And it was from them that I understood what this was about. This is about an energetic shift, and it's about leaving your body. There's an amazing book that really pieced everything together. Every time I needed something, it fell in my lap. There's a great writer called Lacanu, and it's in my book, and I've got the citations and everything. But he wrote about the double, and this is also a Greek concept, that we don't just have one soul. We have, depending on the culture, we have several, but one of the quote-unquote souls we have that is not our permanent soul that's eternal is this double, i.e. our astral body or however you want to put it. Every ancient culture had a concept of this in some way or other. And the whole art of actually, the whole secret, the whole magical shamanic secret of doing this in all these different cultures is about bringing up your animal self. This is my opinion, obviously. Bringing up your animal self, building up a extended astral energetic form, and spending a lot of time visualizing that form as a wolf or semi-wolf and projecting your consciousness into it. So there's really three levels that I could tell from really digging deep in this. There's three levels of this shape-shifting that occurs. One where the person is fully aware that they're not in a separate body, but can send or visualize out their consciousness through this astral form. And in witchcraft, it's called a fetch or familiar. In Nordic tradition, it's called the flygia or flygia. So, and this concept has been around forever. I mean, we know it has. It just has different names. The second, which is I've got in my book on how, I think how to do it, I'm pretty sure I have a pretty good handle on this, is to build up your etheric body and through concentration on your fire center in your body, like build it up intensely through visualization and focus and wrap it around yourself, i.e. wear the skin of the wolf and let your animal self arise, take over, replace, you know, the higher cognitive functions with it, and you are in that state. This is very much, I think, what berserkers were like, because they seemed bigger, they seemed wilder, and they seemed impervious to pain. But when you're in that trance state, you are kind of all those things. There is a third level, which I have not done because it's very serious, but I know shamans do it, and I know that it is a very time, because you have to spend years doing this training. This under a shaman, you have to have some of the proclivities for doing it, and that would be doing all these steps, but then pushing out your double, visualizing the form it's going to take, but then moving your full consciousness into that vehicle, that astral vehicle. Your body goes into a coma, and that vehicle can then go forth and do things. So this takes an awful lot. I found kind of the pieces of that particular ritual in ancient Slavic stuff. It's at the very end of the book. I have not done it. Going into a coma is not something I want to do prematurely. But I do believe this is how they did it. Now, all of them use psychotropic substances. Every time you read about, like, the belt is symbolic, but every time you read about witches or shamans or different cults that I read about changing into werewolves, they either rub some sort of ethnogenic rub or entheogenic cream on themselves. Yeah, thank you. Or they took things. Mushrooms, Amanita, there's a bunch of things that have been traditionally used by shamans and by other people to help with this process of disassociating your ego from your body and moving into this. So that's what I think shapeshifting is. And that's and I've gotten enough confirmation from real shamans. I know people get very touchy about using the word shaman, but I've met shamans from Siberia who are the legit shamans, apparently. Anyway, so that's it. That's real shapeshifting. The horror movies are lovely and fun and wonderful, and I do really like them. But I have yet to see one that really shows that.
Yeah, I think at this point we should put in the disclaimer for anyone who's listening that if they choose to use entheogenic substances like mushrooms or take flying ointment, something like that, or go into a trance, they should either have a trained medical professional with them or a very experienced shaman. You know, we don't want anyone injuring themselves as a result of getting over-enthused.
Yes. I have a very clear disclaimer in my book that, you know, I do not endorse the use of illegal substances at all. In my, where I live now, a lot of these substances are now legal. But I live in a very small part of the United States. So, you know, anyway, that's true. Absolutely. And I don't recommend just, like, going into the woods and taking stuff. That's kind of stupid. So, but this is how, this is clearly what they did in the past. That's what I'll say.
But the other thing is that they were tapped into long tradition. So you wouldn't just have a young kid going into the woods and taking fly agaric mushroom, Amanita muscaria. Yeah. They'd have an older shaman with them who'd teach them the process. Yeah.
Exactly.
Hey, I was going to ask you, so you've been talking about turning into a werewolf by putting on a wolf skin or putting on a wolf skin belt. Now, in your book, you pointed out that because wolves are endangered, we shouldn't be harvesting wolves and using their skins, and
correct.
You suggest using coyotes instead. Now, what sort of differences would there be if you put on a coyote skin rather than a wolf skin?
I think really the skin is symbolic. I don't think it really matters so much. I think the concept of putting on the wolf skin was really about putting on this projected astral form of a wolf that you had been working on for years and years under very intense states of consciousness, and that you could slip into it, you know, you could slip into it and therefore work with it or become it. You can either ride it. Witches were said to ride werewolves to the Sabbath, but sometimes witches were said to, you know, put on the skin and become werewolves and go do horrible things. So this threw me at first, and then I realized, no, it makes perfect sense. It's this double, this astral being that you have empowered and created and solidified so you can either wear it or not. I think the wolf skin, it just becomes a trigger. You know, I am putting the wolf skin, meaning, okay, now I am actually doing this. Coyotes, I'm very careful about this. I have a coyote school. It is verified to have been found. No coyote was killed in it. And I think it's important that you vet anything like that very carefully. If you get it from a reputable person, they can authenticate where it came from. It was not killed in any way, you know, by a hunter or whatever. Those sorts of things I think are poisonous in terms of magical. I wouldn't want anything to do with it. I happen to have a wolf tooth, but it's from a very, very, like, it's from an antique it has been around forever. And so I felt, you know, I sat and meditated with it for quite a while, but felt it was acceptable to have. But I am very cautious about these sorts of things. I don't think these things are really necessary, but we use ritual items in our magic to trigger certain things. And so this is something I think is important.
Yeah, that was one of the things I really enjoyed about your book. You incorporate all these ethical considerations, you know, being wary of where animal parts come from and the like. I really, really like that. So still got a couple more questions to ask, so I want to get back on track. I was going to ask you about Hollywood representations of werewolves. We've covered the dramatic transformations, but when you ask the average person about werewolves, they'll tell you that you become a werewolf by being bitten by another werewolf and you transform when the moon's full and that you're vulnerable to silver. Is there a basis, in fact, to any of those legends, or is that something that's just sprung up?
Well, I mean, you know, you're deeply involved in ancient history and folklore, and all of these things come from something, but of course they've been twisted, and our current culture is not very magical, nor is it, you know, pagan or animistic. So it's been kind of twisted like everything else, and people grab things and move it. But there's a few things, I think there's a few threads of sort of truth to this. One, I found a Roman historian wrote this wonderful, it was in the early, well, I'm trying to remember if he's Roman or if he's medieval, but he wrote about how werewolves, like they were researching these groups of you know, these werewolf cults in Europe, and I think it was Lithuania. And he said, you know, they initiate new people by going to a tavern, and they all drink out of the same beer stein, and that made that person a werewolf. Now, well, that's not the same as biting someone, but the idea of sharing spit, you know, sharing ourselves. I think the sort of unconscious symbolism there is sharing DNA, sharing something personal. In the ancient world, spit and blood and semen and blood, you know, all these things were extremely potent, powerful things. And so I thought that was very funny. I actually recreated that ritual in Werewolf Pack Magic, which is the new book that is at the editors right now. I recreated that.
Cool.
As, you know, you go to a tavern and you sit around it. Yeah, I figured, why not, you know. And so, I mean, you know, I actually recreated a number of the ancient rituals as best I could. One was based around Mount Lycaon, again, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it, of how initiates were initiated into this werewolf cult. And it was about taking off their clothes and swimming across a lake. And in this process, they transformed into a werewolf and then were a werewolf for a year until they swam back and resumed human form. This is just such a powerful metaphor and a powerful symbolism and a powerful ritual practice that I actually recreated that as part of initiation into a werewolf pack. And it just makes so many, there's so many things we can talk about in terms of symbolism and magic in that. But I think it's important that we realize that the stuff we see in movies now is really just made to sell movies. But also to Christians, from a Christian point of view, they all, in the Middle Ages, everyone believed in werewolves. You know, everyone, like literally the church, the Pope announced in the 1400s, no, werewolves are real and you have to go get them. So this was not a small thing. And there, many of them would hide in midwinter, would hide and they would hear the wolves, they would assume they're werewolves. But there were also groups of people that had werewolf festivals and would trek through the snow. And if, anyway, there's more stuff in my book, and they would break into taverns and drink the beer. It was really funny. So clearly, just like there were Green Man festivals and Krampus festivals, there are still these werewolf festivals in parts of rural Europe. So these are all just sort of give us a hint of what the real werewolves were like. You know, they would dress up in furs and run amok and have some fun and worship the old gods. And so I guess nowadays they're, you know, running through London attacking people and I don't know. Silver, as far as I'm concerned, silver is not a problem with werewolves. In fact, I think it's an important symbol of werewolfism, because the moon is, in fact, throughout the history, the full moon especially, is connected with the ability to transform, the ability to shapeshift, and it makes sense on so many levels. We all know that the full moon changes people. My friends who worked in institutions said, "Oh yes, the full moon. It's true. Everybody gets crazier around the full moon and stuff." So there's this, and of course it's the water in our body and so many other things, the tides and all that. So I see silver as a positive emblem of werewolf magic.
And silver is pretty well universally aspected to the moon as well, much as gold is aspected to the sun. Your book contains an Abramelin werewolf spell. The thing that intrigued me about that is that the Sacred Book of Abramelin the Mage specifically warns people against using any of the magical squares until they attain to the knowledge and conversation of their holy guardian angel. Do you have any concerns about your readers working with this square without having first worked the system of Abramelin? Or do you feel that because you have reinterpreted this spell and composed a creative interpretation of it, they should be fine?
Well, I'll add a third possibility. So I spent over a year doing the knowledge and conversation ritual in 1980, and from my point of view, great success. I mean, I had, I passed out. I had a full vision. I had a download for 3 days. And blah, 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 blah. I wrote a book about it. It's called Your Holy Guardian Angel and You. Anyway, so I actually, every night I sit down and I try to work with my Holy Guardian Angel. And I asked about that. And my Holy Guardian Angel said, "Nah, you're changing it completely. It's not what he knew." And I also got the feeling, looking at those squares, that he wasn't really quite sure what to do with some of them, that they came from somewhere else. So I reconfigured the entire thing into a completely different ritual. I sat in ritual form. I sat when I was shapeshifted and took a look at it, and it checked. It was like, okay, I've changed it into something utterly different. And my Holy Guardian Angel kind of said, "Yeah, go for it. It'll be all right." So I don't know. I'm either delusional or I'm right. One or the other. I don't know.
You've talked about the benefits that you've acquired from practicing werewolf magic. So without breaching any confidentiality requirements you may have, how has it enhanced the lives of others who've practiced your system?
Well, that's something I'm just discovering now, because the book came out in 2020, right in the middle of the pandemic. And there were some very funny things that happened. I don't know if you know this, but there was a Facebook page called Howl at 8 p.m. that had, 8,000 people on it. And during the pandemic, when everybody was losing their minds, all over the world, especially in urban areas, people would go out at 8 p.m. and start howling. And I thought that was the best omen ever. I thought that was the best omen ever. Like, I had just sent off this book, and all of a sudden I'm reading, like, I'm out at 8 p.m. howling with people, and I'm thinking, yeah, this is something that's supposed to come out now. Okay, this is clearly I've hit the zeitgeist somehow, But so, I mean, it's hard for me to say. I know. Of all the books I've written a lot of books. Almost never do people write me or contact me. People have been writing me and contacting me about this book. I mean, I know people who are working it. I mean, and people are writing me for advice. They're like, okay, I've done this and this, and now what do you suggest? I'm like, oh, my God, these people are actually doing it. This is, like, awesome. So
it is awesome,
I think the book is really clear. I've been a university instructor for 20 years, and I've been a teacher my whole life. And so I tried to make it like, okay, do this, do this, do this, do this. You wrote me a lovely review. I really appreciate it. First best one I've ever seen. And I got the understanding from what you wrote. that you could follow it just fine, and it made perfect sense to you. And whether it's something you wanted to do or not is different. But I think anyone who sat down with it and said, like, I've had people write me and say, I've always felt that I've been a werewolf. I've always felt that I've been a shapeshifter. I've had this people from many different countries have written me and said, I've always felt that I was a werewolf. I had no idea what this meant. And I'm reading your book now. I'm like, oh, I can do this. And I've started doing this, and I've hit this part, and I'm not sure. Tell me, do you have advice for this? And I'd be like, whoa, okay, sure. You know, so I know some people in the area who are working with it, and they are super happy with it. They are, you know, losing some of their neuroses, and that's the kind of joke that goes around is, you know, once your animal self has taken over, you lose all the stuff that makes us crazy. A lot of the stuff that makes us crazy, you lose your neuroses a lot. You lose your self-consciousness. You lose that voice in your head that always tells you what a bad person you are. I mean, you're just existing as an animal. If you get to that state, you're just existing. You're just being, you know, it's like werewolf Taoism or something. I don't know. But when I'm in that state, I'm not thinking. I'm just being. That's pretty healthy, I think. So it seems to me that people are getting something out of it. I am hoping more do. One of the things I realized after writing it and getting these conversations was that I still had a huge pile of stuff for packs, for werewolf packs. And I put it together, and I was just going to shelve it, but then I realized people wanted to work in groups because primates and wolves are pack animals. We want to be around others. So that's the second book is, how does this work with a group of people? And that was very challenging for me because I was like, you know, I go out in the middle of the woods and rip off my clothes and howl and scare everybody. Okay, that's one thing, right? You do it with a whole group of people, it's all of a sudden it's a different ballgame. It's a rave now, you know. So I've tried very hard to adjust it to a group. That's the new thing, and that's one reason I'm talking to people who are doing it and saying, "Does this make sense? What do you think? Is this too much?" So I'm getting some guidance even now as it's being finally edited.
That's really cool. You've actually preempted my next question. I was going to ask you about the sequel, and I was going to ask you about any other projects that you may have happening. Just thinking about it, it seems that each group's going to wind up being a little bit different because you've got different personalities coming together. So different groups may be a little bit more extroverted. Other groups are going to be more introverted, and they're all going to come to a state of balance. I think we're living in exciting times for those people who want to immerse themselves in werewolf magic.
Thank you. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, one of the things I did when I went back through it and edited it myself several times. The last time I edited it, I went back through it and I kept adding the phrase, you know, be creative, you know, be creative and unique. There's no group that's ever going to be like you. And I try not to limit some of the ritual practices. I'm like, you know, do this. This is the ritual, but you can change it anytime you want. You know, this is the standard way it should be done. But in your group, decide what you want to change. There's nothing in my book that I feel shouldn't be changed by a group of people who say, you know, we prefer to do it this way. We don't want to burn lavender. We don't want to burn, bay leaves. We want to burn this, you know. And I think it's also important that people pay attention to their biome. I mean, where I am, cedar is prevalent, and I believe in burning cedar bark and cedar leaves. But if someone's out in the Mojave Desert, you know, they're going to be burning things that are part of their ecosystem. They're going to be working with the spirits and the energies of their ecosystem. So I try to include that as well. So, I mean,
each
to his own. The whole idea is it's not canonical. There's no set, you know, there's no set belief system or I don't know. It's not a religion. It's the idea is to try to free your animal self and then listen to it. and then pay attention to it and get out into nature and stop destroying wild animals and stop destroying nature and stop committing species suicide by global warming and toxicity. And I mean, these are the things that I think are important.
Yeah, actually, as I pointed out in my review of your book, I think that werewolf magic is a wonderful starting point for people to embrace werewolf magic. But then once they've gotten into it, some people will want to work the system as you've written it, while others are going to tweak it so that it better suits their needs. And once you start having group scenarios, there'll probably be even more tweaking to suit everyone in the group.
Yes, I hope so. That's my goal. I mean, every magical group I've been in has been like that. Most potent magical groups I've been in have been small, and we've done things the way we wanted to do them. You know, we've taken rituals from Crowley or this or that or the other thing, and then we changed them. We added this. We changed this. We brought in some invocations of this goddess or that god. I mean, I think that's real magic. Is you don't just go by a book. You know, it's not. I mean, you can memorize a ritual over and over again. That's fine, but this is really primal stuff. I mean, this is, in a way, this is a deep psychotherapy. This is unleashing your animal self and trying to rip through your neuroses and your fears and everything that's keeping you from directly connecting with the world around you, with nature and other people and everything. So different people are going to have different ways they want to do that, you know. And that's fine.
And I hate to interrupt at this point, but we only have a couple of minutes, and I'd love for your guests to share their contact information.
Yes. Oh. Please let people know how they can find out more about you. Well, you've got a website blog.
Yes. No, I was just thinking, like, you know, go online and Google me, but don't do that. Yes, I have a blog. My students do that, and they're like, Denny, you're into some weird stuff. I'm like, yeah, I know. My website and my blog is, you can reach by werewolfmagic.com. So werewolfmagic with a K at the end, .com. And I'm on Facebook as Denny Sargent, DennySargent. You'll know it's me because I'm in the Sahara Desert. And you can friend me or you can talk to me. I also have an author page on Facebook, which is Denny Sargent Author. And I also have an Instagram, which is Denny Sargent Author. So that's pretty easy to get a hold of me if people want to. I also have an Amazon author page. So I'm pretty easy to get a hold of if you want to get a hold of me.
Very cool.
I would love to hear from people. Yeah, absolutely.
you may regret saying that once the system takes off and thousands start embracing it around the world.
That'd be great. Then I'd have places to stay around the world, and I really want to get back to international traveling again. So, yeah, sure. Can I stay at your house? I'll teach you werewolf magic. Yeah, why not? That sounds like a good deal.
That does sound like a good deal. So are there any other projects that you have apart from the sequel to your book? We've got 2 minutes to go.
Well, I'm going to break news here for you. The third book that I'm going to be doing, very likely I'm going to be doing, is going to be called Feral Magic. And I'm going to extend the deep dive I did into werewolf magic, I'm going to extend it to other feral archetypes. For example, like Sasquatch, and anyway, there's a Yeti, and there's a lot of primal deity forms out there that are asking for some part of this. So, I mean, the great wolf spirit is like hovering over my shoulder, but there's a lot of other ones. There are tree spirits. There are all kinds of spirits out there that want some access. I mean, that some people who there's people who don't particularly care for the idea of werewolves and wolves, but they might be fine with, say, goats, or they might be fine with seals, or they might be fine with other animal spirit forms. Mm. Kitsune in Japan, or Tanuki. I mean, there's lots of places where these archetypal feral gods exist. So
they're going to cut us off now. Thank you so very much. Awesome show. I wish it was longer. And please, Tony, invite Denny back. There's lots more to still talk about.
Thank you
so much.
Thanks for coming on, Denny. Thanks for letting us get to know you a little bit better. And I wish you success with your future endeavors. Have a great evening.
Same to you. Don't forget to howl.
And on that note, thanks for joining us tonight.